Oh, I'll give you my number six, which is the most important one of all, is the color really matters. But
No
you know, if you're
doubt.
not happy, if that shoe doesn't make you happy just in how it looks, are you going to go wear it out on the trail?
So you're being serious. You're
I am
being
being
serious, Mark.
serious. You know I'm always serious.
If it doesn't look fast, how are you going to run
How are you going
fast?
to
So
run
I'm
fast?
with you. Yes. And today on Trail Runner Nation, we're going to talk about the only thing between you and the trail.
And that's your shoes. Who doesn't like to talk about shoes?
We're going to talk to Dr. Mark Cucuzella and Dr. Ryan Green and learn everything we can about the shoe.
You've tuned into Trail Runner Nation, where we have discussions with people that can help you become a better runner and hopefully a better person. Now, a few short messages before we get to Dr. Green and Dr. Cucuzella.
We'd like to congratulate our show producer, Doug Mayer, who just completed Tour de Jeanne. That's 330 kilometers, 90,000 feet of climbing through the European Alps.
And he did it by fueling and training with UCAN. UCAN is a superstarch, which means it's easily absorbed into your digestive system, and it has a slow burn. No peaks and valleys, no highs and lows in your energy level, and it's easy on your stomach.
And not only that, Scott, it really tastes great, and it makes you want to drink it all day long.
And you can get a deal by going to ucan.co/trn and entering the code TRN20. You'll get 20% off. That's ucan.co/trn. The code is TRN20. Try it out, and you'll love it too. We're excited to introduce you to one of our newest partners, and that is Athletic Greens. They have a product called AG1 that Don wants to talk to you about.
A single scoop of AG1 is a whole food dietary supplement. It has 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, and it tastes great. I've been a fan of green drinks. Stir it up, drink it down, feel great. However, this is even better and stronger than I've ever tasted. I just love it.
They've made it so it is really tasty, which makes it easy to use on a daily basis. And there's a lot of different benefits that we'll be talking about in the future. But here's what you need to know. Athletic Greens is giving you, the Trail Runner Nation audience, a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five of their free travel packs with your first purchase. This is where you go. athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation, and you're automatically in. That's athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And my name is Scott War. And today we have two people with a lot of initials behind their names. We have Dr. Mark Cucuzella and Dr. Ryan Green. Both have been on the show in the past, and they're here to join us to talk about a fun subject that we all as runners love to talk about.
They're not only knowledgeable doctors, but they're also runners, and they own running stores. And so they have fielded questions every day, either from their office or from their shoe store, and we're going to talk to them about trail running and shoe selection.
And so they see it day to day and know what that is. Of course, Two Rivers Treads in Shepherdstown, North Carolina?
No, West Virginia.
West Virginia. I know. I knew the city.
Trail Nation, right?
And Ryan Green owns Varsity Sports, which has five locations. Is that right?
We have four locations.
Four locations.
Of Varsity Sports in Southeast Louisiana. So we have one in Baton Rouge, one in Mandeville, and two in the New Orleans area.
So let's kick this thing off, and I'm gonna start off with a story to give you an idea of how clueless I was as a new runner. I decided I had a friend that was gonna train me for a marathon, and I decided I better go get some running shoes. So I went down to the local ABC sporting goods store. And I walked in there and I saw a wall of shoes, basketball shoes, training shoes, all sorts of different types of shoes. And there was a section that said running shoes. So I went to the wall, and after looking at a whole bunch of them, a very friendly teenage looking kid came out and said, "Oh, you want these?" And he reached up as high as he could go, to the most expensive pair of running shoes. And he said, this is what you want. Went in the back, says, what size shoe do you wear? And I said, oh, I don't know, about an 8.5 or a 9. Went out and got a 9, brought it back, put it on. He said, walk up and down here. I walked up and down the aisle and he said, how do they feel? I said, they feel great. And he said, looks like we have a winner. I bought those and those were the first pair of shoes. Took me all of about 20 minutes to buy this pair of shoes. And so my question is, when you have somebody that is asking you, I want to start running, where do you direct them? What's the first thing that you think of? What's the first simple rule about choosing a shoe?
Well, I think that when you are trying to find to select a good shoe, you really have to find a credible source. And so, Scott, you went and talked to that nice young man. And, you know, the issue is that a lot of times there's marketing hype. There's influence from the big companies as far as what the sales folks should do or should sell, right? Because maybe they're having a sales contest. Maybe this is the latest and greatest thing. Maybe this costs $240 and we want to push a lot of these. And that's where you as the runner, as the consumer, really need to kind of sift past that and really say, hey, what is the goal of the salesperson on the other end? Is it to help me out and what my goals are? Or is it to push the latest shoe that has come out? And so how do we know that they're looking out for our best interest? You know, with my sales staff at Varsity Sports, I would tell them, hey, you know, ask lots of questions of the customer, right? What are they doing? What are they using the shoe for? What are their goals? Do they have any medical history we need to know about, right? So Mark, just like you ask your patients, the same kind of thing, and Don, same with you. You ask your patients, what's going on? You do a medical history. We're kind of doing a health history, specifically, you know, to get to footwear, but you really want to learn about that customer and what they're doing. So if they're asking you a lot of questions and take a genuine interest in why you're here, what you're doing, I think then as a consumer, I would feel comfortable knowing that they're asking you those questions.
Good, because there's a lot of variables, right? Short runs, long runs, trail runs, road runs, you know, who knows? And they may have medical conditions, you know, certain plantar fasciitis, they may have some peripheral neuropathy, some things that are going on down below that you need to know about to evaluate to find the right shoe.
Dr. Mark, how do I find that credible source?
I mean, I think word of mouth is actually important, you know, so I think looking at who owns the store and is it a big chain or, you know, that's just a corporate, thing, you know, or is it a locally owned store? But I think, you know, like Ryan, you know, has medical credentials behind his store or stores. So I think there is a legitimacy to that, you know, so kind of to tag on what, you know, what things do you want to know even before you pull the shoe out? So you got to know the history of the person. But the other thing is a physical exam. I learned that like, you know, my first year in medical school. You know, so if the person's not pulling a shoe out and doesn't even look at your foot, you know, and examine your foot and see what, do you have any structural issues with your foot? You know, it doesn't pull out a Brannock device. And like, do you all know what the Brannock device is? It's that old, that thing that looks like a piece of metal that has a little slidey thing. Like, oh, I'm an 8, just pull an 8 out. Yeah. So are they actually like assessing the strength of your foot, the structure of your foot? You know, so we, in our store, I mean, you take the shoes off, take the socks off, examine the foot, and you walk before you run, right? So I want to run, I'm going to get a running shoe. But, you know, as you all know, you know, with new running programs, you know, for people that have medical conditions, you know, maybe they're a little bit older, they're trying to get back in the shape, they're probably walking more than running. Whatever you're picking out for them, you know, if they're in New Orleans, you know, they should be able to do a nice run walk up the St. Charles line, you know, on the grass. And if they got to walk a bit, that's great. If they jog a bit. So it's not like they're going to have two pair of shoes, you know, like they carry one on a backpack. Well, I got to run a minute and I got to switch it out. So those features of, you know, for that person, what they're going to walk in and what they're going to jog easy in is exactly, it's like you doing a 200-mile trail run, Don. You're going to be walking, you know, for you, maybe you walk 5% of the time and you run that entire 200 miles. He's laughing at me, right? He's like, no, I'm running the whole freaking thing, right? There's no walking in this 200-mile run. I mean, you're walking, you know, probably 70%, right? I mean, mm-hmm. like other than a flat. And so whatever you're choosing needs to be appropriate for your terrain and your comfort level. So there really is that, you know, Ryan and I know about like the shoe marketers and big companies will want you to have this step and feel, right? Oh, that's nice and mushy, soft. It's beautiful step and feel. But, you know, I don't believe in that, but I believe there's some comfort in, you know, what feels good at 2 miles. But yeah, there is something to comfort that matters, but not just when you step on it standing in the store. You know, that kind of comfort is not meaningful.
So let me ask the question to both you medical experts. What kind of information should I gather from that step and feel? You know, so I want to put it on. I'm going to walk around the store. I may even, if I'm at a proactive running store, run up and down the front sidewalk and come back in. What kind of information can I gather in that 2 minutes? Should I really think that that's going to help me, or am I just being fooled by the marketing department that this is the shoe, but it's not good for long term? Can you guys address that?
You know, I was just thinking, as Mark was mentioning, I want to dovetail, and that was my second thing, is what feels best.
Yeah,
right. So that initial comfort was my second one, right? So, you know, Mark's absolutely right. You know, we tell folks when they step into the shoe, how does it feel, right? It's got to feel great right away. And in those 2 minutes, I think you can tell a lot. It's like first good impressions. Okay. You can tell a lot. Now, will it feel the same at mile two, or in 2 minutes rather, as it does in mile 100? You don't know until you get 100 miles into it. So I think any good store will say, you know what, take them out for a while. I mean, some companies have 30-day policies. Mark, I don't know what mm-hmm. yours is.
Yeah, but we do 30 days. You can bring them back. Yep.
Right. So I think walking around in the store for 2 minutes is going to tell you a little bit. But Don, I really think that you really have to go take a lot more time in that shoe, because your foot changes too at the longer you wear the shoe as well. So I think that initial comfort is good, but then you need, you know, what's going to keep you in that shoe? What's going to feel best? What's going to give you, as Mark says in his book, what's going to give you the most joy in getting out and running?
A quick question about that, if we can go down a little bit of a tangent. You know, I've heard about these 30-day, you go out and run in them for 30 days, and if you don't like them, bring them back. What happens to those shoes when you take it back after somebody's been out on the trail and they're dusty and, you know, you can't resell them? What do you do with those? The manufacturers take them back?
I donate them to our recovery center. We have an opiate recovery center that these patients have no shoes, no nothing. And we're trying to help them. Exercise is amazing for opiate recovery. That's another topic. So I've probably given 300 pairs of shoes away to different treatment centers.
That's great.
They truly appreciate it. So if you have any shoes to donate and you're listening to this, you can mail them to Two Rivers Treads and we'll get them to a recovery center. If you have some you just don't like, 400 South Mildred Street, Ranson, West Virginia, 25438. Send me your old shoes and they will find happy, happy, happy feet.
Good.
For people trying to get their lives back. I'm glad you did too, because we're always like, oh man, we need a 9, you know, like, because you just dump them off and let people go have at them.
Yeah.
A lot of people learn from Mark's model, because, you know, the companies, what they used to do is say, hey, we want them back. We want to examine why the shoe didn't feel right on that person. What was wrong with it? What was the defect? And then after a while, they realized, you know, we're just getting a little bit of information from that shoe, because we don't have the foot that goes in it. So we don't mm-hmm. know exactly what is going on. So, you know, companies will say, hey, you know what, just we'll credit you something towards that, or give you partial credit, you know, whatever you decide to do. You guys keep them. And then like Mark, they'll say, hey, donate them to a, you know, to a recovery center, or to hurricane victims, or to, you know, to a local nonprofit or something like that, and see what you can do. So,
or your poor starving trail runner friend, you know, like sometimes we'll have some gently used shoes and, you know, there's like, you know, some youngster that's, you know, trying to scrape by, you know, and like, oh wow, like a gently used pair of, you know, awesome ultra topos that just wasn't the right fit for that person who tried them. It's like, oh my God, you just made their day. Here's a free pair of shoes. And they're like so happy.
So I have a question. Should I feel bad about a consumer bringing the shoe back? Is it going to cost my local running store money, or whose pocket is this coming out of? Because me as a consumer, I might think, you know, I really love my local running store. I don't want to cost that person any money, so I'm not taking them back.
Yeah, I don't know about Ryan, but this is very unusual. That I think if you do a good job on the front end and you do a good job fitting people and you let them actually do a pretty adequate try and go jog around the block, it's pretty unusual. I mean, you'd say they can bring it back, you know, if you don't like it, but it doesn't happen that often. Mm. And when it does happen, I mean, people aren't going to these small local independent running stores to like wear a shoe for 30 days. It's like the mattress phenomenon, right? Mm. You can buy a mattress online. What do they tell you? You have like 6 months and they all end up in the landfill because they're just trying to have a free mattress. I don't think they might go to, you know, Zappos or something and try to play that game, but I don't think they're going to your local community store where the employee has spent like 2 hours with them trying to fit them and just using them for internet shopping fodder.
Because the important thing about the local stores that you guys always talk about this on the show is they are funding your local events, your local community. They're so involved. So you're not just buying shoes, you're establishing a relationship. And that's important in anything that happens, whether it's retail, whether it's in healthcare, you know, in the area that I'm in, or and Mark, you know, you have to establish that relationship. And once you have that relationship, don't feel bad, you know, Don, if you have to go back to somebody and say, you know what, this didn't quite work, but I want to make it work. So let's continue to work through this process. So that's the way I would look at it.
Well, you know, related to that number one simple rule and number two simple rule, how long should I expect to take when I go into my local running store to fit my first pair of shoes? I mean, can I go in on my lunch break or how long does this take? And is there a better time of day to go, in the morning or in the evening after I've been on my feet all day?
I think that if you are going in for the first time, it's going to probably take longer than somebody that's a returner that is happy with what they are wearing. You know, I've certainly had customers that have come in their lunch break. They've called ahead. They're pressed for time. They know what they want. They haven't had any issues. I don't need to go through a big, long conversation with them. But, you know, our general rule of thumb was allow at least an hour. Now, look, it may take 20 minutes, but you've allowed time. You've told the person, this is a process. I'm going to take time with you. I am not going to try to come in and grab what's on the top shelf and send you out the door in 15, 18 minutes. I'm going to spend time with you and learn about you and what we're doing. And that's not going to be a 5-minute conversation. But I would also say, as long as it takes, I've had people there on a busy, busy Saturday. It's 4 or 5 hours. Because they've taken the shoe, they've gone out and run for 10 minutes per shoe, and we've gone through 7 pairs of shoes. So, Mark, what about your experience?
Yeah, it's like Ryan says, there's kind of two camps. There's like medication refills, which is, okay, I like this. Here's the new, like say it's the Superior, and it's the Superior 4, and they have the 5, and they love the new color. It's pretty easy. And then there's like a new consult, you know, that has no idea. You know, they walk in with a shoe with a tight, narrow toe box and big elevated heel, you know, and their back hurts and tons of cushion and no one's ever explained. And they have diabetes and they have neuropathy. And, you know, so that's I'll walk in at lunch sometimes and my store's right across from my hospital. And, you know, my employee has like 20 boxes of shoes out. And I know they're doing a good job because and that's like midday. I think sometimes like midday is probably if you need time, because midday at a retail store, at least where I live, is not like busy. So it really, really does vary. And we take, like Ryan says, you take as much time, and those are the folks that really appreciate it. And they come back because they know that the service they got at that retail where someone actually took interest in them and actually has been trained is so different than if they just went to like a big box sporting goods store. Because, I mean, no fault to the big box. The employees aren't, you know, they're covering golf, running, tennis, hiking. I mean, they're just, usually a teenager that's been trained just in the stock, you know, but to have experience with running, you know, like, you know, Ryan has spent his whole life running himself, studying running, getting PhDs in movement. I guess it's not a little area of just niche interest for him as a hobby. You know, this is his career.
This is my everything. I mean, you can see the on the wall, you know, behind me, everything's running. And so, you know, I do it, but I love it as part of my profession, as part of all of my professions. And, you know, so like I said, I've had somebody that's come to me on a Saturday and it's a retail setting, but it's like a medical consult, you know, and it takes time. And Don, you know, it takes time to do medical consults as well. And so, it's busy. People will wait, you know, to get the right kind of service if they know they have a credible source, you know, and every store, any good credible store will do its best to train its employees, whether they're, you know, whether they're high school students, whether they're college students, whatever employees you have, whether they're empty nest moms who I've, you know, had as well, you do your best to train those employees with, you know, as much medicine as you can, so to speak, so that they can help really help those customers. Because again, you're trying to set this customer up for lifelong health, right? We're not just talking running out on the trails, getting out and run a weekend race. It's to keep them moving throughout life and moving well with a lot of ease. So I think that's really where it, you know, that comes in. But Scott, I do want to address your question exactly. Time of day, end of the day is better. End of day is better to get to come back around to that, because and you alluded to it, your foot is as large as it's going to be at the end of the day. I mean, if you think about, and I don't wear this for the poor people that have to wear shoes that are tight dress shoes and beyond those all day, at the end of their day, their feet really hurt because they have a tight toe box in their shoe, and it feels fine at the beginning of the day because that foot is not swollen. It's pretty relatively narrow. The volume of the foot is smaller, but as you're on it, you know, gravity's pulling on you during the day. Fluids are, especially if you're just standing and not really moving around, fluids are moving down to the lower extremities. And so the feet, they do swell. And so the best time to do is either at the end of the day, after you've been on your feet, or after you've done a run where your foot should be swollen. I mean, I've had sweaty folks, and Mark, you probably have too, come into your store on Saturday mornings after they've done their, you know, long run, you know, and the shoes they came in with are muddy and dirty and dusty from the trail. And it's like, okay, leave them outside. This is great. Let's do this right now.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Don, for your ultras. So I size up a full size of my shoe if I'm going to do an ultra, you know, like anything where I'm going to be on my feet, like 8 hours. Like I usually wear like an 11 and a half or 12, but I'll pull a 12 and a half or 13 out. Because I know, like, at the end of 8 hours, 12 hours, I'm going to be very happy. And then, have you ever hit your toe on a root in the middle
morning
of the night, Don?
This morning.
Yeah. So, like, I think for, you know, this could be number three. Like, for trail running, you know, go kick a rock 10 times with that shoe. And if your toes are okay, that's a good trail shoe for you. Because if you're out there on the trail, like, and you just run into stuff, right? And if that shoe is really tight on your toes, you know, have it a little room in the toe, right? So like, yeah, you need a little space there. Like if your toe's right up against the front and you whack your toe, the first one sucks. The third one really sucks. But the 10th one, really, I don't even need to say it. You would just yell, right, on the trail. You're just like, you throw out the F-bomb because you're just like, yeah. But that's another thing if you're out there doing longer stuff. Give extra space.
And I think for that kick the rock that so eloquently was said, you know, if you
highly talking, medical,
right, definitely medical. You know, I always told our employees, hey, give about a thumbnail distance as a good starting point between the end of your longest toe and the end of the shoe. And I always said longest toe because your big toe is not always your longest toe. Sometimes you have Morton's toe, which is the second. To the second toe. So that's a good place to start, right? So for the we'll call it casual runner that's maybe doing a, you know, 5, 10, 15 miles a week versus somebody that's doing an ultra, right? So you have to scale it depending on what they are doing. But I think a good place that we always told our employees was about a thumbnail distance, or, you know, half inch or so. But, and again, Mark goes up a little bit, which is great.
When you size up like that, does that mess up the fit of the other parts of the shoe? Like they do have a little bit of an arch rise in the shoe. If you're sizing up, does that move that and affect the foot differently in an adverse way?
Yeah, I'll just chime in. Usually not, because you're not looking at one shoe size is a third of an inch. Okay, so people think, oh, I went from a 12 to a 13. That's a massive difference, but that's only a third of an inch. So it's not that big. So people have to kind of get their shoe size out of their brain, like that this is like something rigid, like, you know, your dress size, like your waist size, like, you know, if someone suggests you go bigger, you're highly offended. Yep. You know, so we have to like dissociate shoe sizes from other things that really people have, you know, a lot of personal attachment to. And again, like, you know, as Ryan's saying too, it depends on what you're doing, right? So you don't need to have that little bit of extra space just going out on your daily run. So you may have your shoes that you just go do your daily runs. But if, you know, you have an epic event, you know, on your agenda, like Don has, you know, you never want to be in a scenario where you made a simple mistake that's going to wreck like 6 months of training and all your preparation. Like, damn, you know, I just like made a bad choice here and I'm in pain. So these are just little things for those scenarios. I just get people to think about, and that could be like their race day shoe. If they like a certain shoe, like an ultra superior size 12, but if they're going to go do a 100 miler, maybe they would actually get a fresh pair of those shoes in a 13, because they know at day two, after kicking 12 rocks, I actually had an experience just with socks and the 100 miler I did. Like, I needed to change socks because they were felt great when I started. But they were by day two, they were too tight, and I felt like they were tourniqueting me because they didn't have enough expansion. But I, you know, obviously I'd never tested those socks in 2 days of running, but you know, so yeah, you learn things. You know, luckily my friend who was pacing me, I just like, can I borrow your socks?
<You know? laughs> No, that's a pacer.
That's a good friend, right? Like, just because you're like, yeah, like, look, my feet. And it's like, oh my gosh, like that feels so good now, just to relieve all that tension, that pressure, because your feet really do get swollen, you know? So these are kind of your, you know, you know, when you make your rules, these are like your addendum for, you know, multi-day extreme type of stuff. Like, where do you, exceptions to the rules under these conditions, you know, which gets people to think critically, you know, like, okay, I like this, but under these conditions, I might make this little modification to something that works for me 99% of the time.
You know, one thing that might help your listeners is I always try to teach my employees, people have a foot size. They don't have a shoe size, right? So when people are born, right, they have a foot size and their foot size grows, and then we decide to put shoes on them. So I always said, okay, you know, what do you think your foot size is? And so we would kind of change their mindset, right? Because you certainly have the customers, and Mark's absolutely right, that they think, oh, I've been a 10 my whole life. You know, I can't possibly be a 10 and a half or 11. It's like, well, shoes change, the fit of shoes change. Your foot is not the problem. It's the shoes that have to work around your foot. So maybe that just kind of simple twist of terminology will help your, you know, your listeners as they go to try on shoes. You have a foot size. Let's make sure the shoes work for your foot size.
Yeah, that could be rule 4. You have a foot size, not a shoe size. I think Ryan just came up with rule 4.
Yeah.
On the fly.
Let me ask a question. How consistent are shoe brands, one from the other, on shoe size? One's a 11, one's a 13. They might be the same size. What are your thoughts?
Not at all, right?
Oh, not at all. Like, it's, yeah. Because you could have, oh, I'm an 11 in New Balance, but they have one factory in Vietnam, one factory in China. Then they make these big clunky things in New England to say they're made in the USA, you know? But yeah, so, and then one's narrow. Yeah, no. So even within brands, completely different. I mean, there's a you know, bell curve margin error 10-ish, but they don't, it's not straight correlation for sure.
And then even on the production line, you know, even if it's the same shoe being being produced this whole week in this one factory. I mean, something's made and there might be some hand stitching that takes place. Something happens on a Monday morning when people are 8:30 in the morning and they're fresh. And then this other shoe is finished off Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, you know? And so that may alter, you know, there's always human error, you know, in this, and that's something that we need to acknowledge.
Yeah. Think about this. Okay. So a shoe has 6 millimeters drop. So what is 6 millimeters? It's like this little bit of drop. So think about this. You're cutting thousands of shoes with some machine or maybe a human involved in some way. So it's each of those shoes could be exactly a 6 millimeter drop.
Probably not.
I mean, there's no way, right? There's no way. So when something says 6 millimeters, you know, I mean, you're just kind of taking that for what it is, but and then you step on it once and you mush it to 4 millimeters. Yeah. Depending, you know, you're a bigger, stronger guy than I am, Scott. You would smush it quicker than I would. So all that stuff is not precise.
Did Mark just call me fat?
He did.
Mark
did.
Just no, call me fat. You've got more muscle than I do.
Stronger.
did not say that.
Husky.
Big bone, Scott.
You're a strength runner, and I'm like one of these like marathon types. Friends can joke around with each other.
We're going to take a brief pause from our discussion about shoe selection and talk about short selection. Scott, have you ever stepped up to your running cabinet and decided, what am I going to wear today? Which color, which style, what am I going to do? With Jonji, the decision is easy.
They have their new fall release artist series prints designed by Christian Gehring, a Jonji field team member and named one of the most under-the-radar professional trail runners by the American Trail Running Association. He's an artist and he has captured the American Southwest in this series.
I absolutely love that look. You've got the great colors that pop in the canyons, the blue skies, the cactus. You've got to love the Southwest.
Jonji also donates 2% of their running apparel sales to clean water projects around the globe. Make sure you check out their fall winter 2021 line by going to jonji.com. You can get 15% off by entering the code TRN15. That's jonji.com. TRN15 is the code.
And now back to Dr. Green and Dr. Kukuzela to talk about the 7 simple rules to shoe selection. You guys made the best case for not ordering over the internet. Even if you've had the shoe, you've had the size, and this is your 4th pair, there's no guarantee that 4th pair is going to be like your 3rd pair. You need to go in, slide in, get the old step to the step and feel test, and make sure it meets your requirements. Dr. Green.
Now to that same point, you know, Mark does, they do virtual fittings, you know, so you could do, you know, a virtual fitting. And Mark, you can explain that further. You know, stores had to be really creative, you know, in the past 18 months to keep business going. Just to keep it going, not even, you know, just to survive. So at that point, you know, you can do virtual fittings. And I think that's going to be something that's going to stay. So when we say buying from the internet, it's different. You know, it's different than it used to be. Right now, we've harnessed technology to help us, you know, make things go. And I think that buying over the internet is okay. I don't want to demonize. It's okay if you do processes like what Mark does at his store, what Varsity Sports did during, you know, the early days of the pandemic when people couldn't go anywhere. So it is a little bit different as far as internet buying. I understand what you're saying, Don. Don't just go to East Bay, you know, and just buy, you mm-hmm. know. But it has changed. Internet buying has changed.
Can we talk about that? Can we talk a little bit about how COVID, perhaps it was COVID, that made the change to a virtual experience? What can we expect? What do we want to look for? What kind of experience are we going to have if we're going to try to do this enhanced experience of buying a shoe, not in the brick and mortar building?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just speak for my store. I mean, COVID made us think and grow and do different things. You know, I mean, we were kind of forced to do it. So we do Zoom fittings and we've done quite a few, and it helps engage some of our customers who might be out of state, you know, so a lot of it's the history, right? And you can, even with someone's phone, they can show their foot, and if their toes are all crammed in, you know, you can Oh, wow. Like I see that stand on one. I mean, you can kind of MacGyver it a little bit, but I think people just like to have a person to talk to that understands running. Well, gosh, are you just walking in the park or are you training for a 100-miler? You know, that person on East Bay, you know, customer service line, and East Bay is like a big shoe warehouse for those that don't know what it is, wouldn't be, and they're not expected to be able to do that. You know, so it's helped us kind of use technology, just like in medicine. We went from like zero virtual visits to like 90% of our visits are virtual, like in 2 weeks, right? People, wow. Like before the pandemic of telemedicine, this is too much of a pain in the ass. But then when the money was on the line, right, the healthcare system is losing, you know, hemorrhaging. Oh, we need to figure out these virtual visits. And yeah, so, and it's good. So now we've actually engaged a lot of patients who don't like coming in or live pretty far away. So there's some upsides to just, it forces you to learn the technology. We still prefer, you know, for me personally, I don't know about Ryan, like if I can see someone's foot, see how they stand, see how they walk, you know, that's obviously better than the virtual, just like in a medical office. But sometimes the virtual is better than the alternative, nothing. Which is nothing, you know.
And I might even be able to make a case that virtual could be better than a physical, because now you're really diving into questions. When you lose your vision, all of a sudden your hearing and your smell becomes better and more acute because you have to listen and bring things in to make up for that lost piece of information. So maybe your history taking becomes better. Maybe your dialogue, maybe your, let me, show me your foot with that phone. Let me see exactly what it looks like, because now you have to use different resources. So I might argue that your virtual experience could be better with the right person behind the phone.
But that goes back then to rule number one, somebody's a place that's credible, you know, and I think that you're right. And, you know, Don, you brought up a good point. You know, use all of your senses when you're trying on footwear. If somebody's being evaluated, you know, I always told our employees, hey, you know what? So we were one of our stores, and Mark knows this store in Mandeville. It was in an old house. Okay, like early 1900s, raised house, all the houses are raised in South Louisiana. And so there was an echo to the wooden floor, right? So we would hear people walk, you know, across the floor. And so if they really hit hard and there's kind of an echo, you know, versus kind of the lighter wispy feel, think Scott versus Mark in running, you know, Husky versus Wispy, right? You know, that's an advantage that we have in how that person functions, you know? So I think, you know, that using your senses got further enhanced as we had to go virtual. You know, you really had to rely on, hey, I'm not there to put my hands on them and see what they do. So you really need to be creative. So I think that's how COVID has, you know, maybe changed a little bit of how we do things there.
You may or may not know this, but I used to be a skier.
Mm-hmm. I'm well aware of that. I'm painfully aware.
Similar to running, ski boots fitting is paramount to being an efficient skier. And one thing that I always did when I got a good boot that fit is I would go and get a pair of custom orthotics for my ski boot. And I never relied on the orthotic that came stock in my ski boots, because I wanted to have just super, super good feel all the way around my foot. Because if you tweaked your ankle just a little bit, you wanted the boot to respond, which made the ski respond. I go into running stores and I see walls of orthotics. Some are moldable, some are off the shelf. You can get custom orthotics. Is this something as a new runner that I need to consider?
Well, I will defer to Ryan as the expert in skiing from Louisiana. So, Ryan, what's your experience in ski boots? Just we want Ryan's comment on the ski boots here.
You know, it's
growing up.
Thanks.
Well, you're from Jersey.
So I'm from New Jersey originally, and I can't, you know, so mountains, New Jersey, Louisiana, all over the place. What I would say is, what, you know, why do they tell you have to put an orthotic in a shoe? I'm going to go to the run, take the skiing example, go to the running shoe. Why right away? How do they know how your foot is going to interact with that shoe right away? Right. So you have companies that they say, oh, this has to go in every shoe. Sometimes you even have in a shoe insert companies, I'm not going to name any, shoe insert companies and shoe companies that do a lot of partnership. And they say, okay, well, if you recommend this shoe, you should also recommend this orthotic. So immediately we're charging the person $200, $250 right out the gate. And we don't even know how their foot is going to interact with the shoe. So I was never a fan of that. I just did not think that that was a good practice to get in. You know, orthotics and you know, Mark and I have talked to Jay DeSherry, who you guys have had on the show a bunch. He said an orthotic is really kind of a temporary fix for something. You know, get back in and get the foot to do its job. And that's what, you know, Mark at his store does so well is, you know, they work on strengthening the feet and get the foot pliable, get the foot mobile, get it stable. Let it do what it's supposed to do. Don't put any extra junk in there that's going to interrupt that natural interaction. And let's see how that does first. And then if there's a medical reason to put that medical insert, because really an orthotic is a medical device, put that insert in there, then okay, then so be it. But it shouldn't be something that you have to have for 10 years. And I had plenty of people come into my store and say, hey, I've had this orthotic for 10 years. Well, why did you have it? Well, I had plantar fasciitis. Was it gone? Oh yeah, it's been gone for like 9.5 years. And they still wear it. And that kind of broke my heart.
Gosh, I don't know who first said it. It could have been Dr. Green, Dr. DeSherry, Dr. Cucuzzella, Dr. Maffetone. Notice the trend. They're all doctors. And they said, if someone put a knee brace on you because you had knee pain, would you continue wearing it for the rest of your life? I mean, and that's to your point, Dr. Green. Why are you still in that orthotic? Your foot's better now.
Yeah, Irene Davis talks about that too quite a bit. She's probably the leading researcher. I could share on the show notes. It's probably about a year old. I published a little article in Lower Extremity Reviews just on the different types of insoles, you know, and what they do. But ultimately, you know, we like as Ryan's saying, if you have a structural problem, a true structural bony problem that can't be fixed by neuromuscular rehabilitation, right? The nerves and the muscles retraining themselves. But you know, you're a diabetic and you have a collapsed foot from, you know, multiple fractures. You need something to help you walk again. But our ultimate goal is proprioception and to train the neuromuscular system to get those 100 small intrinsic muscles that are attached, you know, some locally in the feet, some going up your lower extremity to start firing again. But we could share that in the show notes. But the ultimate goal is to get those muscles to be awake and to fire and to rehab. You know, brace something initially if it hurts, wean support and increase strength. That's the physical therapy athletic training principle with any extremity injury is support it to protect it, but then wean support and increase strength. You know, and most people we see are in that camp. Like they have a pretty structurally normal foot. It's just weak and we want to retrain it. And then every now and then, oh, okay, you actually need help, right? And then they need something custom. And they're usually someone older, you know, with diabetes or, you know, trauma to the foot, something very structural to the foot. But that's not the majority of teenagers on the high school cross country team walking in and walking out with a super feet. You know, that to me is malpractice because I want that kid's foot to stay strong for their life and to start bracing that kid's foot just because, you know, they might get an incentive from their employer to upsell the shoe to give them an insole. And now you're putting something in a kid's shoe that might ultimately weaken their foot.
And to your point, Dr. Mark, if you don't work on retraining the neuromuscular system, then the bones themselves or the joints themselves are going to take that extra abuse.
Yes.
And you will need an orthotic at some point because now you'll have fatigue.
Keep the muscle strong.
The bony structure.
Bones take the hit.
So eventually you need it. You've got to have your musculoskeletal and the neuromuscular system functioning to protect the skeletal system.
But you need someone good to look at your foot, right? You just need someone good who knows what they're talking about. Ryan, you know, he trains his employees. You need someone to know who actually needs the support forever, but who we want to wean the support. You know, they might need support now because they've got bad plantar fasciosis and they can't walk to the mailbox, but we want to wean that support and increase the strength. like, how do you make that determination? Which side of the road are they going to drive on, the right or the left? You're the right, stay supported for the rest of your life. The left, let's try to wean you out of support. I think you have to see a lot of feet to make that decision. You know, a good clinician can do that.
According to my scorecard, we are up to 5 simple rules. What's the next one? Who wants to tell us what number 6 is?
Oh, I'll give you my number 6, which is the most important one of all, is the color really matters.
But, no
you
know, doubt.
If you're not happy, you guys are trail runners, right? If you're not happy, if that shoe doesn't make you happy just in how it looks, are you going to go wear it out on the trail?
So you're being serious.
I'm being serious. Mark. You know I'm always serious.
If it doesn't look fast, how are you going to run fast?
You're going to run fast.
I'm with you. Yes.
I don't know how Nike picks out the colors for those alpha flies, but they're very flashy, unique. And you got to be bold to wear them. Like if I'm a dude and I'm going to put on a pink alpha fly, I'm going to run fast that day, or I'm going to walk out of that course in complete embarrassment. Like if I put on the alpha fly and I break 2 hours for the marathon, like no one's going to laugh at me for the pink shoe. Now, Ryan, the color. Tell us about the color in varsity sports. How much does the color matter?
Color matters a lot.
Yeah, look at this. You guys are learning new shit.
Wow.
Right?
I mean, for the customer.
Yes.
And it's a battle, you know, it's a battle really to say to the customer, hey, what is your goal? You know, and they say, okay, well, I need a pair of shoes that is going to look good with this run that I have coming up or outfit I'm wearing or something like that. So that I hate to say that really kind of changes your sales mindset as well. And it was a struggle for me, but it's like, all right, let me get you in some footwear that is going to help you get out the door and be active and be healthy and happy. And like Mark always says, find your joy in whatever you do. And you know what? Sometimes they succumb to my peer pressure. I'm just kidding. They would realize that the color didn't matter quite as much because it really felt good and they were going to be able to go out and be active and do what they wanted to do. But what do people do when they first come into a shoe store? They look at the wall. They see the color and shoe companies know that. You know, they know that. And so that's where, you know, we have to help the customer kind of look past that to what their goals are and how we can help them achieve that. So,
hey, Don, is right now a good time to share the story about how you switched shoe brands recently?
Well, you can go ahead and start it off, Scott. I'll weigh in.
Well, I noticed, you know, Don has been running in a certain shoe brand for many, many years and raced all of his 4 200-mile races in this brand. And the other day, we show up. We don't get to run together as often as we'd like, but we did get to go run the other day together. And we show up, and he's wearing a different brand shoe. And I went, what? Don, why did you switch?
Well, I mean, just the name in itself really swayed me. I mean, how can you not pick Speed Goat? I mean, it's fast. You're a climber. I mean, I had to go there. And then the color.
And he's a goat.
Yeah. And the color. It was marigold and blue. And it was just like, have you seen my eyes and my hair color, Scott? I mean, it was the shoe.
Yeah, I think that's Walmsley's shoe, you know, my former Air Force teammate. Yeah. So that brings him magic.
Yeah. Hoka is making
pretty,
a good
pretty
shoe
low
right
drop
now.
For the trail. It's light.
Who is the hottest shoe going right now on the trail? Now, that's not to say who's the best, but when people walk in, when they say, I'm looking for a pair of blank, is there any trend? Do you see it happening or it's just all over the place? At Varsity Sports, Ryan, what do you see?
So I'm not on the sales floor as much as I used to because I'm teaching at the university now. But when I go and I go in and see Bud, our manager, I say, all right, what's hot right now? It's Hoka. Yeah. Hoka is, and you know, Hoka can go on road and trail pretty easily, for whatever reason. You know, some of it is because of the thickness, the amount of cushioning. So if you're on the trail, people don't want to feel the rocks undulations as much, and it works for them. It's worked for medical practitioners that say, yeah, they should be in a bigger, thicker shoe. And it works for road people because they don't want to feel the firmness of the road. And that's where then it takes employees to say, you know, well, you're supposed to feel some some things, and we can get into that later. But to get to your point, Don, you know, HOKA really is hot. So, you know, Mark's store is a minimalist store. Mark, I'll let you talk to this in a second, but ours has some minimal, and it had a lot more when I was there day in and day out, but has gone to, you know, it's what's hot, what's selling. Is it it's the Brooks, the Asics, you know, the big names, the Nikes. They're not making shoes as compatible to, again, to foot sizes and foot function as other companies like Ultra or Zero. You know, Steve Sashin's done a great job through the years, and his staff. You know, we had Mark and I have a good friend, Cedric Scotto, that actually was one of my employees and one of my students. And, you know, he went to Zero because Zero is, they're not a huge player, but they're making some waves and looking at foot function, how the way the foot works. And so I think, Don, it kind of depends on what the customer, what is hot depends on what the customer is looking for as well.
Mark, what do you find in your store? What are your customers, or what is your store manager telling you that's hot?
Yeah, and I'm in there quite a bit, you know, do little walk-in clinics. And, you know, I think half of our customers are walkers. You know, mm-hmm. They're folks that are older, looking to be balanced, you know, not fall. Flat shoes, you know, so like, yeah, Zero, I think, you know, it's not the most popular shoe because it is truly minimal, but for elderly folks who just want to walk and have balance, so this is a large slice of the aging population. You know, so my mother, for example, she fell twice when she's 80, and she always loved her Asics. Like, she's just tied to these Asics, and she had a fear of falling, so she didn't want to walk. She didn't want to go out and walk anymore because she was afraid of falling. And she just came out, and I said, look, I'll give you some shoes for Christmas. And she'd never worn a minimal. My dad was already sold on minimal shoes. He's had two knee replacements, hip replacements, and he calls his shoes the clown shoes because all of his golfing buddies. And then they're like, can you tell me more about those shoes? So he's worn like old school Vivos golfing, and he's got like three pair of Lems, which are another minimal shoe for balance and walking. So I put on a pair of Vapor gloves on her. You know, her favorite color, red, because it's all about the color. She's like, I like that color. I'm not making this up, right? 80-year-old lady, you know, shopping for shoes. It's all about the color, you know, as primary. Secondary is how the shoe feels. She loves that shoe, and she's out walking with her sticks. And I gave her last week, a couple weekends ago, because she was wearing them out, right? So I grabbed her a pair of red, favorite color, Vivo Barefoots. That, and she's like, which for the winter, because they have a little more grip. She put those on, and she's like, oh my gosh, they're wonderful. Like, she doesn't know she doesn't know they're minimal. I just say, here, try these on. How's your balance? How do you feel? You know, so that's one group. So walkers, really flat, wide. People have a preference of cushion, flat, balanced for the walkers. But for the runners, you know, I'm seeing we put people in low drop shoes. So, and again, like, you know, we're not a true minimal. I mean, there are plenty of people. I'd say the most popular shoes leaving our store now would be like a Ultra Superior, Lone Peak, Topa Flylight, you know, or one of their Topa comparable trail shoes that have, you know, legitimate cushion, because we live right on the Appalachian Trail, and you do not run unless your feet are like bulletproof. You don't go run on a Vapor glove, you know, for a 2-hour run on the Appalachian Trail. But even people that, you know, I encourage people to walk and live in the most minimal shoe as possible.
So Mark, for years you've been telling us minimal is superior because we have proprioception, we're able to feel where we're positioned, and we can recruit the muscles to help absorb some of the shock and not just rely on our joints to take the shock. Just because you put a cushion doesn't mean you're anti-gravity. You're still loading joints.
Your joints are still hitting right. Right.
Now, how do both you, Ryan, and Mark answer this question? I understand what you're saying, but these stacked shoes really feel good.
I mean, I could take that quickly, but yeah, they do. So I think if you train your foot and train your balance, train your running. So if you do a lot of your training, it's like say you're going to do a downhill mountain bike race, right? Just all out, you know, balls to the wall, right? You want the biggest tire shock absorption bike, but you have to develop the skill to control that bike, right? So like you look at like Jim Walmsley, he's the most amazing trail runner in the world. He is like a downhill skier like Bodie Miller going down the fall line. So he's got immaculate athletic skill. And you put a pair of cushion on him and he goes even faster because he's developed the skill. So you have to develop the skill, balance, and strength. And then on based on the terrain you're on or your goal, I mean, most of us training every day, just out, you know, doing mental therapy, we really don't care how fast we're going. But if it is a day that actually, you know, you want to actually perform, yeah, then put on something that lets you kind of roll down that hill a little quicker than you would if you had to kind of, you know, gentle step it. But you have to have the skill first before you can do that, or else you're going to fall. You know, if you think, or, you know, if you've done any trail ultra and you've got really bad technique and you think you're pounding down that hill because your shoes are protecting you, you'll realize about halfway into that race, that we've all been there, right? You're like, wait a minute, I thought this shoe was protecting my quads. Why can't I not move my leg right now? Because I was like, no, your quads just took all that load.
Dr. Vergeen, you want to support that or add to it?
Or conflict it? That's my experience.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely add to it because Mark's a great friend and super smart. I never want to refute anything he speaks about. So
no, this is all good.
I know. I'm going to use a trampoline example, right? So we have a trampoline in the backyard and the kids are on it every day. My kids are on it every day. And they've developed a skill to do all kind of tricks, feel comfortable bouncing on it, right? I don't get on there unless I'm forced to. So I don't develop that skill every day to land on that unstable surface to control myself. And I think if you take that to footwear, it's the same kind of thing. You know, Mark's absolutely right in that you have to develop overall body skill, body awareness. He's spoken about proprioception, you know, balance, strength. All these things need to work in harmony. And if you have something underneath your foot that is not allowing your body to react properly and put yourself in the best position to be safe and efficient and healthy, then I think you're asking for problems. So I always told folks, find the lowest possible drop in the least amount of cushion that you can comfortably wear. Right. So that would, the closer we can get to the ground, the more we can feel, the better our body typically can react to what's underneath of our feet. And the better the rest of our body will react to that. Right. Because our feet is the first thing that hits the ground. And then our body is a chain reaction up and our body moves around. So that was kind of what I would always tell customers. Let's see how low we can get you and see how comfortable you can be in those. And sometimes it's a process, you know. The beginning of this show, we've talked about that process, and it may take weeks, it may take months to really figure out what that is.
I'm going to add to that if I can, not that I should, but I'm just going to pitch this out there. If we start in a high stack shoe, we may never learn to run efficiently, because with the lower stack shoe, we start to listen to our body, we start to alter our gait, so we minimize impact, and we become a smart, efficient gait runner.
I would say start as early as you can, as low as you can.
Yeah. And then when you end up, and this is part of your lessons, Mark, early on that you taught us, go out, find some grass, take off your shoe, run, become efficient, put the shoe or feel efficient, put your shoe back on and reproduce what you did without the shoe. Don't now change your gait to adapt to the shoe. Make the shoe do what you did when you were running barefoot. Use that efficient gait that you learned in a shoe. I think it calls back to those earlier lessons.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe this is kind of your voodoo lesson. Maybe, I don't know if we want to give this as number 7, but there's something magical about what your body learns by your barefoot on the ground. That could be grass, that could be some pavement, but it wakes things up. And I don't think we're ever going to find like the full science of this. But once your body can start to appreciate that, things start to change, even in our whole digestive system, inflammatory system, neurologic system, how we move. But just walking bare, and don't do this if you have bad diabetes and neuropathy and you've got ulcers. But like if you can feel the ground, spend some time barefoot. Magic starts to happen. And maybe that could be rule 7. Magic will happen if you take your shoes off, which will enhance any activity you do that involves shoes, whether you play basketball or play soccer, you know, look at the best soccer players in the world, you know, whether you run, right, look at the best runners in the world. There's something about barefoot that's not just your basic science of foot strength and biomechanics. There's something else. I mean, it's getting toward the end of the summer now, but probably 90% of my miles this summer have been completely bare feet, you know, mostly on grass. And because I'm just using running as therapy this year, you know, my life is wake up early, run, go to the hospital, deal with coronavirus, try to sleep, repeat. It's a mess here in West Virginia. But if I go decide to run a trail ultra this fall, I'll put shoes on. But there's something about that that's somewhat magical, but it's called earthing, and people can put that in their search engine, you know, in the scientific literature. But that, I'll kind of like close a little bit with that to, you know, discover what you've yet, you know, the unknown unknowns, right? So people talk about all this sciencey shit, you know, I can say that word, but there's something mystical about true minimalism, which is no shoes, which will teach your body things that you will transfer to when you put shoes on that you can't take away.
And as you made that comment halfway through, Dr. Green picked his foot up to show that during this episode, he's in his bare feet. And halfway through this discussion, I'm standing. I said, why am I in my shoes? I kicked my shoes off. And so I think I bet you there are others that have listened to this that have done something similar, that have did what I did, which kick the shoe off. Why do I need this shoe on to stand here? I don't. There's no rocks underneath my feet.
You know, we can learn, you know, to Mark's point, we learned so much from being barefoot. So my day job, I'm assistant professor at Louisiana State, Southeastern Louisiana University in South Louisiana. And, you know, so a lot of the time it's warm, you know, where we are. And so in my classes here at Southeastern, I teach anatomy, I teach athletic training classes. And for some of the classes, I'm like, all right, guys, just kick your shoes off and socks. Okay, we're going to do some things. And so their first reaction is, ooh, I'm going to take off my shoes and socks. So far, nobody has punctured their feet. There's been no diseases, no athlete's foot, anything like that. And we'll do different exercises. And I won't even, tell them what they may feel, what the result might be. So we do it barefoot. And I'm like, all right, we'll do some one leg balancing. We'll do some, single leg, mini squats. All right, put your shoes back on. All right, and we do the same thing. And they really find it's a lot harder to do those normal activities. So for our kids that, in our athletic training curriculum, when they're taking somebody through a knee rehab program and they're doing balance and proprioception or ankle, ankle sprain rehab protocol, take off the shoes and socks, right? We want to get all those proprioceptors on the bottom of the feet to be alive, be engaged, because that feeds the rest of the body. So, again, take off your shoes and socks, just walk around, sure, make sure that your surface is safe, but there's times I walk from my office down the hall to the classroom, sometimes across campus barefoot, and I think people are afraid of doing that, but you really can learn, as Mark said, some really magical things just by spending some time barefoot every day.
When you get back to the faculty room, do you have some of your colleagues say, Dr. Green, would you please quit having the kids take off their shoes? It's getting ridiculous.
Well, it did when I first got here. Many years ago to the university, but now it's like, oh, it's just Dr. Green's, kids, his students, the barefoot professor, which is actually what Dan Lieberman, Mark, up at Harvard, he's the barefoot professor. But I'm that version down here, and people are just used to it. And you really do learn a lot by doing that.
Hey, this has been a great discussion. I have one final question. How long should my shoes last? I'm right now, I just came off of a weekend where I had a little bit of knee pain and took a couple days off from running. And today on my run, I was thinking, how many miles have I run in these shoes? I wonder if I have this knee pain, acute. I wonder if it's because I haven't gotten a new pair of shoes lately. How long do my shoes last?
I have two answers to this. I had one when I was getting fed the information from the shoe companies, and then I have one answer when I've been here at the university day in and day out. So typically we've said it's 6 months or 500 miles, right? So you see that in the shoe kind of shoe prescriptions, right? And that's just kind of a really generic time frame, right? But 6 months or 500 miles of running for all four of us is going to be different, right? For all of your listeners, it's going to be different. And so the thing was, you said, okay, you would buy two pairs of shoes a year. So I knew that that person was coming in twice a year to buy shoes. And I meant no ill will to that person, but that was just kind of a general rule that we were fed the information from the shoe companies and then passed it on. But let's fast forward a number of years where I don't have to really interact with those companies from a marketing perspective at all. I've had shoes that I have run in now for probably 3 or 4 years, but because my running mechanics, I feel in my own mind, have gotten so much more efficient, I don't rely on the shoe as much as I once did. I do so much barefoot, you know, so much of the foot exercises, the foot doming, you know, that we've talked about, and the MOBO board that Jay has, Mark, right? You guys probably all have that.
We have that.
Yeah, I mean, I use those all the time. All these toys that, you know, Mark has in his home office, I have here in my office. These are things to help my body continue to strengthen and move better so I don't have to rely on the footwear. And then my shoes last a lot longer because they're not under the same stress and duress that they were when I was just kind of running willy-nilly. So I think as a runner, we need to be, and you know, you guys have heard this before, we need to be the experiment of one and see how long it's going to last for us, and listen to your body. So, you know, Scott, you said, oh, my knees kind of bother me a little bit. Well, let me go back and take my own medical history and see what I need to do. And that may change your time frame versus somebody else.
Good answer.
Right. And we go back to our recent discussion with Kelly, the AT.
Certified athletic trainer. Yeah.
The first question being, Scott, what have you done recently that you haven't done in the past? And maybe it's because you've increased X, Y, or Z. Maybe that should have been the first question, not do I need a new pair of shoes?
No, I need a new pair of shoes.
Oh, you know why you need a new pair of shoes? The color, pal. They've got some color that really pops and some names that are really hot, and you need to go that way.
Hey, guys, thank you so much. I think this is going to help not only that new runner who is confused with the wall full of shoes, but I think it's a good discussion that we need to revisit as experienced runners, too. You know, these are an important tool in our toolbox, probably one of the most important tools. I mean, it's what puts us on the trail are our shoes. So thank you so much for your advice.
It's the only thing between the trail and us. It creates that intimate relationship. So it's very important to us how we connect with the trail, and that's shoe selection.
So go out and run in your shoes.
Mas.
Hey, Scott, a trail race doesn't happen on its own, and a podcast doesn't happen on its own either.
No, we need to thank all those that provide and help us produce this good content. We want to thank the Patreon supporters. We really appreciate your contributions, the small aid that you make every month to help us improve on what we're trying to do here. We want to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who is enjoying UTMB in the heart of Chamonix this week.
We'd also like to thank Soundman Ryan, who's with every episode and making sure that we're keeping on course.
And editing all of the bad stuff out, keeping the good stuff in. He's turning really all of our 3-hour podcasts into less than an hour podcast. That's 2/3 of the crap we say gets edited out.
We'd like to thank Doug Crumley, who is going to be running his first 100-mile run coming up. He's a business-level Patreon member.
And a new addition is Yana Gibalova, who is our social media czar. You may be seeing some really cool social media content coming out, and she's responsible for that. Don and I don't even know how to log into those social media accounts, much less provide good content. And she's there to help us out. She's an active trail runner also, and we're glad that she's on board.